Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to our show.
Hi, Laura. I'm here.
Yay.
This is Kate.
I'm the developmental interventionist, for those of you who have not listened to us in the past.
That's right, and today is Thursday, November 13th at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, so if you're listening to us right now, you're listening live. We'd love to have you call in with your questions or your comments, and let me give you that number. It's 1-718-766-4332, and tonight we're continuing our series that we started last week on autism. And last week we reviewed the criteria for diagnosing autism from that DSM-IV manual, and we had that great document that we used called the Plain English Version of that. And if you have not gotten a chance to look at that, or if by chance you missed our show last week, there's a link to that document on the website at teachmetotalk.com, and it's under the comments section on the article for last week's show. So I'd like to encourage you to take a look at that if you didn't get a chance to look at that already. And tonight we're going to continue with that same theme with we're going to review some huge social and language milestone markers that indicate the need for a referral to rule out autism, and I'm going to have those again on the website. I originally put those in an article called When to Worry when I first started the site back in January, and these were guidelines from an autism organization, and I have looked and looked for that reference in this last hour and can't find it. Hopefully I'll get that on there for those of you who are very conscientious and want to go back and look at that original source for that. So we're going to talk about that first. Then tonight we're also going to go ahead and give you what Kate and I think are great resources for those parents who are in the initial processes of being diagnosed with autism or with a social communication disorder. And then lastly, I hope we get to this today. We never get to what I say we're going to do last. But I do want us to spend some time talking about the whole, do I get my child formally diagnosed or not get my child formally diagnosed? Because I have parents really on the fence about that in the children I see. Do you have parents that really kind of go back and forth about that, Kate?
Very much so. Sometimes it's a process. And I, you know, as a parent myself, understand that we're not always ready for things initially. But, yeah, it can be. Sometimes they really don't get there even in the lifespan of when they're with first steps, which is, you know, under three. But, yeah, it rarely is, does a parent say, I want to get that done immediately.
Yeah.
Occasionally we have parents coming in saying, I think he's autistic. What do you think? And so those parents tend to want to, maybe go ahead and get the formal assessment quickly. But understandably, a lot of parents have misgivings or are fearful, or we'll talk about it in more detail. But yes, to answer your question simply, I do.
So I do want us to get to that tonight. So we're going to have to go fast to make sure we get all this information covered. But before we start with any of that, I want to talk about this special offer that's just for our podcast listeners. If you've not yet ordered Teach Me to Talk the DVD, today would be a great day to do that because I just authorized a coupon for $10 off. But here's the catch. You've got to have a special coupon code, and that's, let me tell you where to put it. It's when you order, when you're in the site at teachmetotalk.com and you check, you go into Google Checkout, and there's going to be a spot during the checkout process for a coupon code. And in that space, you would type POD16. Again, that kind of stands for pod for the podcast. POD16, no space between the letters or the numbers. And my business partner has instructed me to say this is a very limited time offer. It's only for podcast listeners, and I'm not going to mention this coupon on the site. So if you want that, you need to write this down or rewind and listen to it from Blog Talk Radio. It's POD16 is the coupon code for that.
Well, Laura, that's cool. I didn't know you were doing that. Only
yeah,
for our
either.
Listeners. And with that was the first DVD, Teach Me to Talk. Aren't you working on another one as we speak? Seems like you're busy with that as of late.
That's been my thing this week. And actually, we were supposed to have that out a little sooner, but we've run into some production problems with that. But it's called teach me to listen and obey. And I talked about it a lot a couple of months ago when we were doing, or I guess that was just, maybe that was September, when we did that little series or a few weeks on language comprehension or understanding language. And I first started to talk about that and thought that it would be out by the time we finished up that series, but apparently not, since we've done sensory processing disorders and have now moved on to autism. But that should be out soon. And we've actually divided that into two DVDs, one for kind of the basic things, basic receptive language with younger kids, say up to 24 months. And then the older version, or part two of Teach Me to Listen and Obey, will be for kids who are developmentally at the 24-month level and, say, on up to four. So I'm very excited about it. I hope I have an announcement about that in the next week or two. We're a lot closer. And let me say that I have now learned to edit videotape myself. So that should tell you how desperate we got with those problems, trying to solve those. But anyway, thanks for asking about that.
You're welcome.
Let's get back to what we're talking about tonight with autism. And I have been trying to read this list, this big list of milestones that children should achieve in their social skills and in their language skills. And this list, have you taken a look at this list, Kate? I think I sent that to you.
I was trying. Is it the one on your site? On your
right, it is. It's the one that was originally in the article, When to Worry. And these are very, very generous.
Is that under the autism? You know, the.
I think that it's actually under the section that's on expressive language, and then I think it might also be under the section parenting. But the name of the article is called When to Worry.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, American Academy of Pediatrics also has used this same unnamed reference on their site as well, this same list.
So it's a well-cited unnamed reference, huh?
That's right. And it's funny that I can't find that, because I'm usually pretty careful about saving those original references in case anybody asks me. That's the grad student in me. Still, but let's talk about these big milestones. And again, they're pretty generous. And it's, if your child has not achieved these milestones, it's unlikely that there's not a problem. Does that make sense? You have to, yeah. It's unlikely that things are moving along great and that your kid is just totally out of the woods and all of this is no big deal if your child is not hitting these milestones. So, again, let's just start with those. And it's
difficult. If we're being honest, we'd say it's highly unlikely.
Right.
Because
and
really,
maybe,
you kind of feel like some of the norms for what is considered age-appropriate in speech are relatively low. And you've stated that they've actually lowered the standard from when you graduated from grad school. So
right. Right. And really, it's when I did my undergraduate degree. The big thing then was that kids, well, and I'll digress just for a little bit, but was by 18 months that kids had 50 words that they were using expressively, or 50 words that they were saying, and that they were doing two-word phrases on their own. And then now we've bumped that up to 24 months. So in my mind, that's taken care of all the kind of natural late talkers, the kids who would kind of be late talkers without anything else going on. We've adjusted the milestone to account for those kids. So it's likely that kids who aren't performing at that level by 24 months really are going to have a delay or disorder. It's unlikely that nothing's going to be wrong with them. And I know parents get so mad when I say that, because they say, oh, anecdotally, Uncle Jim didn't talk till he was 3 and a half. And I always want to say, well, let me ask you about Uncle Jim now. You know, because their definition of fine might not be my definition of fine. You know, when they say, he turned out okay, he turned out fine. You know, that's always kind of open to interpretation. So, again, we want to talk about these milestones tonight and say that they are very, you know, if your child isn't hitting these, you really need to go ahead and get a referral to your early intervention program in your state. And, again, you can find out that information by Googling your state's name plus the phrase early intervention, and you should be able to get information about your program. And, again, that program is in every state in the United States. It's federally mandated under law, and so every state has to offer that. The eligibility requirements are pretty similar from state to state because, again, it's all based on federal guidelines. Most of the time, Treatment is free, and the assessment is always free. So cost should not be a reason for you not to go ahead and make a referral or call about that yourself. So, okay, I've spent 11 minutes talking about all this precursor stuff. Let's get to the big list.
Okay.
So difficulty making and maintaining eye contact with an adult by 6 months. So if you have a 2-year-old who's not doing that, really, you should have achieved that skill in your infancy, because that lets you know that you're making social connections with people. No babbling by 12 months. So that would mean a kid who's not even practicing with sounds, a kid who's pretty silent by 12 months. That would be when you want to go ahead and be evaluated. And the American Academy of Pediatrics statement is, the following signs are a reason to have a child evaluated by a specialist without delay. And that's pretty strong wording for American Academy of Pediatrics there.
Say that again, Laura. I missed it. What was the line?
The milestone, or what American Academy of Pediatrics has said?
What American Academy of Pediatrics has said.
That's hard to say fast, isn't it? Okay. They have said, this whole list, I should have said this at the beginning, it says the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children who have not reached these milestones or the following signs, these are reasons to have a child evaluated by a specialist without delay.
Okay.
This is the recommendation to pediatricians to not miss the opportunity to give the referral. If their patients aren't doing these things, you know, when they go in and do the well baby checks and they do the developmental milestones that they're supposed to do, you know, well baby checks, a pediatrician is, by recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics, is supposed to make a recommendation for further evaluation if they have a little patient who's not doing these things. I know in our area we have pediatricians who miss these things all the time.
And
so
they encourage, in fact, families to delay the process, and they say, don't worry, it'll be fine. When you first read it, the reason I stumbled or stammered is I thought you were saying to get a therapist without a delay. I thought, that's a really good suggestion. We should have therapists without delays. Oh, boy. It must be Thursday night, huh?
Yeah, we're tired, aren't we? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, yeah, your therapist doesn't need to have delays either. That's another good thing that we will add on there. Yeah, okay. All right, so back to the list. Okay, so no babbling by 12 months, no gesturing, which would be pointing, waving, bye-bye, trying to indicate to a mom, you know, your parents by showing you something by 12 months. So, again, if you have a baby who's not waving bye-bye by 12 months, I routinely will get 24-month-olds who aren't waving bye-bye, so they've had that whole year, I guess, where the pediatrician maybe ignored that or where a parent didn't think that was a big deal. So if you have a kid who's not using gestures by 12 months, again, the American Academy of Pediatrics has told 12 months, one year.
I see a lot of kids at 2 years old who, and I think we need to emphasize here for parents who are, you know, thinking through these red flags, these warning signs, or lack thereof, those things need to be pretty darn consistent, because
not just one time. Yeah,
right.
One time 3 weeks ago he did it. Yeah.
Yeah. When Dad left for work. Yeah, and it's like once or twice. And maybe not 100% of the time, but, you know, 12-month-old babies who are developing typically, that's something they enjoy doing. And you say, tell Grandma bye-bye, tell Daddy bye-bye, tell whatever bye-bye, and they wave. Frequently they'll say bye-bye, but certainly they at least wave. And I, you know, again, I understand as a parent why you want to remember that one time, but if your child isn't doing that at least, say, 75% of the time, and, you know, assuming he's reasonably happy.
Paying attention.
Yeah, paying attention and reasonably happy, you get a fairly consistent response on tell whoever happens to be leaving bye-bye. If you're not getting at least that wave, then, and I like that 12-month standard because I think that's pretty reasonable. But
I think it's reasonable, too. And it's actually on my language test, the Rossetti Infant Toddler Language Scale, the test that I refer to more than anything. It's at 6 to 9 months. And my own children were really waving bye-bye.
On the Helpler, I'm pretty sure it's 7 to 9 months. So it's really lower. But 12, I think, well, that takes in those,
It does take into account late bloomers. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking, oh, I just have a late bloomer, he's 18 months old, but he's not doing it, that is probably more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's our point that we want to convey. These age ranges are pretty darn generous. So don't think, oh, he's a boy, he's just going to do it later. You know, again, I think the age ranges have already accounted for gender differences, which we know little boys on a whole do probably talk a little bit later than girls, but we're meaning a few weeks or months later, not, you know, don't say anything till they're three. You know, it's not like that, and I do think parents sometimes misunderstand that.
Right, and the other one I hear is kind of a way to explain that kids aren't doing it. They'll say, well, only when he wants to, and that kind of accounts for some of those kids who only, you know, have done it just a couple of times, and if a child is 12 months or older and they're not doing it fairly consistently, then there's probably some problem that he doesn't want to do it more, if that's the way the parents choose to look at it, you know, I mean.
Right, he's not making the connection between what you're asking him to do, following the command, so it's a language issue, or he cannot understand how to imitate that gesture, how to get that up, or he's missed the whole social piece altogether in that I want to connect with people, and one of the ways that I do that is light up and perform when they ask me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good point with not wanting to. Really, there's probably an underlying developmental reason there.
Because I hear that on those kids who either never do it or only have done it a couple times or do it very inconsistently, parents will say, well, he can. He doesn't do it very much. Yeah, only when he really wants to. And I think, well, I'm not always so bold. I'm bold on this podcast, but in real life, I'm not so bold, and I kind of would like to be able to say, well, he should want to more. And, you know, not any child performs 100% of the time, I'm aware of that. But still, if there isn't something working for that child that he or she wants to, then that in itself is probably something to be a little concerned about. So.
Right, that's a red flag in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, and I think we've talked about this before, but I'm going to say it, so many times parents do the, you know, he doesn't want to do it. He's just being stubborn. He's just being lazy. He's just being bad. You know, that really doesn't account for a kid not meeting these really big milestones. So I could understand if a parent, you know, if a kid was, oh, I don't even know if I can give a good example where I think it's okay, but I hate it when I hear that. And I am kind of bold with parents and visits and say, and I'm like,
it's ironic, because I'm a northerner and I act like I'll say anything, but in real life I don't. Laura's sweet and southern, and she somehow manages to say those difficult things. I always say, I wanted to say, but you in a nice way, do a great job of saying, well, and saying. I'm trying to learn. I'm working on that.
Yeah, and you can say it, and it is disappointing, and that's one thing we're going to talk about, too, when we talk about the whole diagnostic piece. Sometimes I do just sit and bite my lip so I don't cry while I'm telling them what my impression of the problem is, or so, you know, and my voice might shake even as I'm about to say it, but it's bad news, and I realize sometimes, oh, my gosh, you are going to remember me in conjunction with the worst day of your life. But then I think, but I'm coming back next week, and we're going to work on making it better. But given that first, you know, minute of, well, I think we have a huge problem here. He's not really going to grow out of this. This isn't just late talking. You know, that's hard to say, and it's even harder to hear. But it is sometimes hard to say, but we have to kind of take a big gulp and hold our books really tightly so we don't pass out or want to run out of the room and just, you know, go ahead and say it and give that bad news. So anyway. Right. All right, back to the list.
Okay.
All right, no single words by 16 months. So that would be kind of the outer limit for a child really starting to try to imitate and say some words, 16 months, and how many times do we get referrals at 24 months, 26 months, 28 months? Not said a word.
Right.
So no single words by 16 months. No two-word spontaneous phrases other than instances of echolalia by 24 months. Should we talk about what that is, what echolalia is? Did we talk about that last week?
I don't know that we really did, Laura. I think early on maybe at some point we may have said something about it, but I don't think we did last week.
We might have talked about it a little bit because that echolalia means that you repeat kind of a conversation verbatim, or maybe the classic example of that is repeating something that you've heard from a television program or video, where you can kind of quote the whole thing or a couple of lines of that. And sometimes I'll hear a kid do that, and I'll say to a parent, "What?" And they'll say, "Oh, that's from a movie, or that's from Dora, or that's from Sesame Street." You know, and the kid is kind of replaying the whole conversation. I have a little guy right now that's echolalic, that I adore this little boy. I just love working with him. I've worked with him for about a year now. He's over three. But when he has started to get in trouble now, his mom will put him in timeout, and she really hears him echoing the whole instance the whole disciplinary thing. And so in his mind, he's kind of rehearsing that whole little situation, and he says both parts. He says what he did, he'll say what the mom said, then he says what he said back. He does that whole thing. And echolalia does sometimes serve a purpose with kids, or it almost always does with children with autism. You have to kind of connect the dots, though. And it is a good prognostic indicator, meaning overall, if you have a kid that's echolalic, even if that's the only language that you're hearing, it's a red flag. It's not great, but it does mean that they're talking and that they do have the ability to use words. So, again, it's kind of a good and a bad thing all wrapped up into one. It's not, you know, it doesn't mean that things are moving along great language-wise. But if you're autistic and if you're echolalic, it does mean that you have a really good chance of being able to learn how to communicate using words. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course, we've had many conversations about echolalia and how we interpret it and what we think about it. But, yeah, I mean, I agree with you that at least it means that on some level there's talking. It may not be communicative at that point. But
And when we're first seeing a child, we don't necessarily go in and say to a parent, "That's great. That's great. She can sing the whole happy birthday song." You know, please don't misinterpret that we're saying, you know, that that's fine and that that's typical, because it's not. But we're saying that if your kid is autistic, you know, if you're looking at and some children with autism do not learn how to talk ever, if they're severely autistic. But kids who are echolalic at two have a pretty good chance of going on to be able to learn how to use words to really communicate.
Right.
So that's kind of the difference there. And we're going to have a whole show about echolalia in December, where we talk about it at length and talk about what you do to treat that. And, oh, I do think we talked about this last week, because I said it really – it can drive you crazy when you're working on how to treat that. And so we're going to talk about that specifically in December. But let's keep moving, or we're not even going to get through this list tonight.
Okay.
So no two-word spontaneous phrases by 24 months, and that would be bye-bye, Daddy, more cookies, go, car. You know, any time that a kid has put two words together in a little phrase on their own when they are not repeating that you've just said it. They're not repeating you when you've just said it. They're not imitating your model on that. And then the other big thing that's on this list would be any loss of language or social skills at any age. And I know you wanted to talk about that specifically, Kate, how you think parents sometimes have a hard time with that when they don't really. What did you say about that you wanted to say earlier?
My point was, after our last show, you and I chatted, and we always come up with things. We should have said, what about, you know,
right.
Woulda, shoulda, coulda. But I think my point was that it seems that those kids who actually regress, and you mean that loss of language or loss of gesture skills or loss of social skills, or
and that would be a kid who waved bye-bye at 12 months, but then all of a sudden you notice at 19 months he's not doing that anymore.
Right, and I've certainly had those, and, you know, sometimes you have to kind of pull that out of parents, and sometimes other parents say, he used to say, choo-choo and go and eat and bye-bye, and now he says nothing. And I've even had parents offer up videos of their younger, you know, the child when they're younger.
Me too.
Say, look, look, see, he said ball, and darn, the child did say ball, you know. But what I was saying is it seems like some parent, I mean, when parents see that regression, that seems to alert their sense of anxiety or worry over their child more readily and more thoroughly than those parents, those kids didn't have it. You know, it's almost like that if they didn't ever wave or they didn't ever have words or they didn't ever make consistent eye contact or have a good social connection, then they don't necessarily notice the absence as much as those parents who had it. And those parents really, you know, kind of, and, you know, because autism is so much more common and information regarding autism is so much more available, and, you know, we talked about that some last week, but we hear that, oh, did they lose any skills? And, you know, if your child had 5 words when he was 12 months and he's 18 months and he has 0 words, yeah, I'd be really, really concerned about that. But those kids who didn't have it, where they kind of think, gonna come, you know.
they're more generous. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They just And I do think regression, that would be a big red flag for autism, and that is what generates lots of referrals that we get through our early intervention program. And let me just interject a little note here. Kids with autism sometimes show that regression. The kids that are verbally apraxic will do that too. And they might have a word for, a parent might recall them saying a word and then say they don't say it anymore. So that's something that we also see in histories of children who were later diagnosed with apraxia. And, you know, just for benefit of our listeners, apraxia is also a neurological disorder. It's a motor planning disorder, meaning that in your brain, you know the word that you want to say, but, you know, and this is a very simplistic explanation, but getting the word from where you want to say it to your mouth, there's somehow a short circuit and you're not able to say it, you're not able to imitate it. Or what I think happens so much with apraxic kids is a parent who might say that a child has lost a word is they might have actually heard a pop-out word. They've heard a kid, you know, and again, just kind of pop it out and say it a few times, and then they don't ever hear it again. So I just wanted to bring up, if that's kind of the only red flag that you're seeing with your child as we're talking about this, autism is not the only thing that could be the cause for that. You know, there's some other things too, but regression or losing skills is never really, I mean, there's not a positive outcome from that. So that certainly is a huge red flag that you're going to want to get checked out.
Right. And I, you know, with the, if it is in fact autism, other things probably are going hand in hand with that. They don't seem to respond to what you're saying to them like they used to. They aren't using the gestures. They aren't making good eye contact when those things were present. And it does seem like they're almost two, and I'm no autism expert. We will be having an autism expert, I think, or at least a lot closer than I am next week when Dr. Powell's on the show, and that'll be cool. We can pick her brain for specifics.
Right.
But, and I have read about this, but no expert, but it does seem like there are almost two forms of autism, one that kind of is present almost from birth, and then another segment of the autistic population, they seem to be fairly typical until 14, 15, 17, they do regress. So,
or even 18 months or
way.
Even closer to two.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get into the other controversy that sometimes goes hand in hand with talking about those milestones. I'm not even going to mention that, but and
but
I guess by not mentioning it, I kind of did. Yeah, but you know, parents, and I hear that a lot, and we do, like the caller that we had last week, the mom who called in to talk about her little boy that was diagnosed with autism. She said she knew from. Didn't she say she knew from the beginning, or did she not say that?
I want to say she kind of always suspected that maybe she wouldn't let, he wouldn't let her hold him. And
right.
There
and
were
kind
some
of looking
things.
Back. Mm-hmm. And I actually kind of know this person through another person. I didn't know she was going to call in the show last week. That was a big surprise. But kind of thinking about who that was, you know, after I got off the phone and kind of put the pieces together, she actually has a second child now. And in talking to our mutual acquaintance, she tells that person, oh, my gosh, and I knew right from the beginning that he was normal. I knew that he didn't have autism right from the beginning because he just did so many different things and did everything earlier and nothing was hard to learn. And, you know, everything just developmentally came so easy to him. And so, again, I think that speaks to your point about for a parent to see a kid or have an earlier kid or have a kid have the skills and lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Is easier to see than a kid who never had it to start with or a parent who doesn't have any experience with another child.
Right.
So I think that makes a difference. Even me as a mom, our oldest son, who's 19 now, by far was just a much more difficult child. And had I had him second, I think there's some things that I would have noticed in him right away that I didn't necessarily notice as a young mom, you know, at 23, 24, 25. You know, there were things that I didn't think were, you know, I probably thought it was quirky then, but if I'd had my second one first, I would have been saying, whoa, what's going on? You know, there are things you learn with experience too.
Right. And I think it is when you aren't terribly familiar with typically developing babies to think,
right.
Oh, that's just personality, you know.
Right.
That's just how he is and you know, to appreciate him for who he is. But when you see
And there's truth to that, and you
right.
still want to do that regardless of
mm-hmm.
what the diagnosis is. And we all have temperament issues that play into every aspect of our beings, whether it be personality or development or whatever. But you're right, there's a difference between
mm-hmm.
personality and kind of skill mastery,
right.
if you want to look at it that way. Okay, let's talk about something we didn't talk about last week, that when you and I were having our little post-show conversation, I said, oh, I wish we had done a big but. Even if your child is autistic, even if your child does get an autism diagnosis, that's not the end of the story. Statistics now and researchers now, and I had a great statistic, and I can't find that either. I'm doing terrible with my resources or sources tonight. But research is telling us that children who get early intervention, and that would be, you know, in their toddler years, in their early preschool years, fare much, much better than children whose parents wait until they are school age to address some of these problems.
And we certainly see that day in and day out, thankfully, or our jobs would be a lot harder. But
well, why would we even do this job? I mean, why?
Right.
I wouldn't. I know I wouldn't. Not with my personality. I would think, man, I have got to do something better where I am going to get some positive feedback. I cannot keep doing this
right.
if I'm not going to see some progress here.
Right. And, you know, one of the hardest things to me, sometimes I say the longer I do this job, the less convinced I am that I'm qualified to answer that, because parents, even if they do have a diagnosis or they really, really suspect that their child could be autistic, and they always want to know initially, will he talk? How's he going to do? Will he need
right.
special ed? All these, you know, long-term predictive things. And I always kind of say, I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I know that the outcome is better because I think it gives us an opportunity, and more importantly, the family an opportunity to kind of work on foundational skills that, you know, things like that social piece, and that if you get in there and build that early, you're going to have a much better outcome than if you're waiting until a child is 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 and in a school setting. And, you know, it's a much more
right.
natural thing to get in there and try and work on it and address it and make it better at 1.5 or 2 than it is at 6 or 7 when they've all that time.
Yeah, and neuroscientists actually tell us that children's brains are so pliable, I guess would be the real everyday term. There is good information now from, you know, the research that's coming out, and there's a book called Bright from the Start, where I know I read this. I can't remember the neuroscientist's name that did it, but it's called Bright from the Start, and she talks about the research that says that children's brains are much more likely to overcome any kind of incident, whether that be an assault from, you know, like an injury or anything, when they are younger than when they're older. And so birth to three, you know, a while ago when early intervention was kind of, you know, 15 years ago or whatever, and when that was the big, big, big kind of new push, and when that new federal guideline came out that all states had to mandate that program, that's what they said is, you know, birth to three is the critical window, and birth to three is the time when you can make the most difference. And all those statements really were based on that research that says that children's brains actually can change from maybe what they would have been with the right kind of input and the right strategies. And again, that's the only reason I do this job. No way would I be able to do this day in and day out if I didn't think that there be really made a difference. So that's just what I wanted to
see it. And, you know, sometimes we see such huge changes, even between, you know, the child, we get them at two, by the time they're three, it's amazing. I mean, so rewarding, and parents are so tickled. Not every time, I can't say it's 100%,
right,
but it's pretty good. You know, I think with the team and good parents who are really involved in working on it, it can get so much better.
Well, ladies, we have a caller.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Caller, are you there? Hello?
They hung up. Sorry.
Oh, that's
sorry.
Okay.
That's all right.
Maybe they'll call back.
Call back.
We like
that
callers. Yes. Say
call
it five
back.
More times, Kate. Yeah.
Call back. What's our number?
Oh, it's 1-718-766-4332. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe they had to hold a long time till we finished that point. I hope not. 1-718-766-4332. We'd love to hear you. Back to your point that you just said, when you have a good team and when parents work hard, really so much of the information that we read about autism talks about parents really getting on board and really being committed. And I'm referring all to Dr. Stanley Greenspan's work. He's pioneered an approach with autism that's called Floor Time. You can find out all kinds of information about Floor Time. Or let me just start to kind of give the resources too. But floortime.org is the name of the website that really spells out that approach, and it talks about the developmental skills that all children need to meet. There are six major developmental milestones, and again, it doesn't matter how old you are when you meet these. Just the big deal is that you meet them and that you start to master them. And you can find out about that again. It's floortime.org. Another organization that Dr. Greenspan has been involved with is 0to3.org. And again, you spell out those words, 0to3, zerotothree.org. You can also get some other good information about autism and kind of a place to start researching autism, and a place that does a lot of fundraising for autism is autismspeaks.org. And I think that's the organization that kind of pioneered that puzzle piece symbol. Don't you think that's Autism Speaks, Kate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's their website. They have some good information on there, too. So, but back to Dr. Greenspan. His work, he really started with this a long time ago. And the book that kind of started this whole movement where he talked about and introduced Floor Time is called The Child with Special Needs, Encouraging Intellectual and Emotional Growth. And that was the beginning book for parents and professionals to really talk about this approach that he developed. And it is all based on relationships and on teaching a child how to achieve intimacy and emotional growth and kind of meet those needs and work on those things in a one-on-one situation and, again, with their primary caregivers. and then to build on those foundational skills and work toward learning how to communicate, learning how to think. And again, the whole basis for his approach is learning how to relate to other people.
Let me do the follow-up one to that, Laura.
Go ahead.
Because I'm sitting here looking at it, and I was
Go ahead.
Reading some last night. I read it a while ago. But after that one, and to me, this book, and I'm not saying that they should skip to this book if they're interested in checking out these sites, and I think probably most libraries, at least our city, probably has these books, and you can get them through the library, but any bookstore will order them, or you can order them online. But the follow-up is Engaging Autism, and that was, again, by Dr. Stanley Greenspan and his associate Serena Weider, how would you say it? W-I-E-D-E-R, who's a PhD. And to me, that book, the Engaging Autism, it made a little bit more sense, and it was not quite as theoretical, not all about the theory. And to me, that the first book was kind of confusing, even though I really tried to commit it to memory or, you know, my everyday thought process. Engaging Autism is a little bit more about, okay, so we have this floor time approach. What does that really look like? And
right. What,
as a parent, would you do if your child exhibits such and such behavior? It's kind of more, a little bit more practical, hands-on, tells you what to actually do. And
well, it's
I'm
an easier
about,
read.
Yeah, it's an easier read, and it's kind of a little bit more common sense and a little bit more applied as opposed to theoretical. And I got more from it personally, at least as a therapist. But that's the follow-up book that I wanted to mention.
Well, I do think it's easier to read. And the Engaging Autism is, the copyright date on that is 2006. And the Child with Special Needs, I think, I'm starting to need my reading glasses, Kate. I'm getting
I have mine
age.
On. I don't
do
have Engaging Autism in front of me. Hmm.
Engaging Autism is 2006. And the Child with Special Needs is 1998. Yeah, I have it right here.
I was going to say, it was probably not too long after I started in First Step, so that was right about the same time.
Yeah, so that's kind of the, those are his big books. He's written lots of other books. He's written some great, he's written a great book, too, called The Challenging Child. Have you read that, Kate?
No. Mm-mm.
That's a great book, too, that talks about, again, so many children that are, that fall on the autism spectrum have behaviors that you want to address too, whether they be overly aggressive, whether they be under responsive. You know, that's another great book of his too. Those are books that I highly recommend that parents read. Other great resources, and we just talked about a couple of these today. One is called More Than Words. It's a big book. It's the Hanen Program. And it the subtitle is Helping Parents Promote Communication and Social Skills in Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder. It is, you can find it on eBay. You can order it from the Hanen Center. I'm trying to look at the website. Here it is. It's hanen.org, H-A-N-E-N. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm having kind of stressed thinking I might be mispronouncing that. You know, for a speech language pathologist, that's kind of a that's
if
a big deal.
Hanen
we
or
about,
Hanen? Yeah, I don't
yeah,
know.
We kind
I
of worry
said
about
Hanen,
things like
but
that. I could be wrong, and this could be my southern drawl with my vowels with me mispronouncing that name too. But that that's a great book, and it is written really specifically for parents. It's very practical. It's got cute illustrations in it. And the thing that I like the most about More Than Words is it really classifies kids by kind of what level they're at. And I haven't read it in a long time. I'm trying to look through it right now. But it'll kind of classify kids with kids that would be more severely challenged, kids who are I don't want to misspeak and use the wrong word, and I can't find it in the glossary. But kids who kind of do their own thing. And then it kind of moves up to the next kid who might just be starting to really learn how to relate and communicate. And then it moves into kids who are early communicators or early talkers. And then it lastly talks about kids who have kind of mastered that whole, you know, they're up to the phrase level. So, you know, when they're pretty good talkers by then. So, again, that's a great book. And Kate harassed me till I let you borrow that. I know you've been looking for that for a long time. Yeah, and it gives you great ideas. I mean, this is a book that has a chapter about songs, and it even, you know, writes out the words to the songs for you, so you can really look at
that.
Ooh,
I would
and get,
probably really like that. I like the things that actually tell you what to do. The theory's nice, but I really like when they say,
well,
if this happens, do this. Try this. Try this. You know,
this is not a theory
thing.
Book. Yeah, this
good.
Is a treatment book. And, you know, sometimes when we go to all these professional continuing education classes, they'll, you know, it'll be an 8-hour course, and they'll spend 7.5 hours talking about diagnosis. And really, we're all there for that last 30 minutes to talk about treatment. And that's what, you know, I kind of did with Teach Me to Talk, or how I felt about it, is I wanted it to be treatment-driven and still give people real-life diagnostic information, but focus mostly on, okay, here's what's wrong, but here's what we do about it. And More Than Words is a great book for that. I found their wording on this. The own agenda stage is what they call kids who are, you know, and that, boy, doesn't that, isn't that a good name?
Mm-hmm.
Kids who follow their own agenda. Kids who are really kind of socially isolated. Then it goes on to the requester stage. Oh, and I can't find the other two words. But anyway, great book. Can't say enough good things about it. But again, it's called More Than Words. I've seen it before on eBay, so you might check there. That might be another, save you a few bucks on that if you can find it. It's in hot demand here. I know in our lending library, it's, you know, through our early intervention program, people can't ever get that book. Okay, some other resources I wanted to mention. Kate, do you want to talk about Giggle Time and what that is?
I do. One other, I don't know if we talked about mentioning this one, but I think it's worth mentioning because it's kind of related to the Greenspan work with the emphasis on that social connection, is that Communicating Partners. Did we talk?
Oh, that website. Yeah, that's a good website.
Well, there's a website, and then they have a book, and they have some workbooks and whatnot, but that's by Dr. James D. McDonald, and I believe he's a PhD speech-language pathologist.
But I think Dr. McDonald still treats children, and that's a big difference between people who just write about the theory and who just have been in the academic world for so long that they don't even carry personal caseloads anymore.
Right.
And I know I've heard Dr. Rossetti, who's kind of my first real hero in when I first started really thinking, okay, I want to be a pediatric speech language pathologist, you know, and he did the infant toddler language scale, you know, he's the Rossetti of that test. And I heard him say, you know, that he just didn't really even read or give much credence to anybody's work that might pass out if you put a real live baby in front of them. And I think about that a lot. You know, people who are still practicing and who are still seeing children, you know, really do, it's not just theory to them. They know from real life experience what kind of works and what doesn't work. And they're able to explain it to you. So that's kind of a red flag, I think, with the professional. Even people who might just evaluate children, that's all they do, I really would place a little bit more professional credence on somebody who also treated children and who wasn't just an evaluator anymore, because I think they have a different perspective on things. So there you go.
Right, and I think you're right that James McDonald is a practicing speech therapist. I think in the Cincinnati, is it Cincinnati or Columbus? Columbus, maybe.
I think it's Columbus or Cleveland. It's one of those C
I think maybe
C
Columbus
cities.
Because it was Ohio State. But anyway, it's Communicating Partners, 30 Years of Building Responsive Relationships with Late Talking Children, including Autism, Asperger's, Down Syndrome, and Typical Development. But it's really rather similar to the Greenspan work, I think. Not, you know. The other one you mentioned was Giggle Time, and that is called Giggle Time, Establishing the Social Connection. And it was written by Susan, I don't know how to say this either, Laura, Aud, A-U-D. I think maybe she married a Swede or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's Susan Saunders. That would work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all about, I like this book. It's gives a
I
lot
love
of,
this book.
Yeah, real user-friendly for therapists and certainly parents or even preschool teachers or anybody out there in the trenches dealing with kids. It says, a program to develop the communication skills of children with autism, Asperger's syndrome, and PDD, which we know from last week is pervasive developmental delay, kind of that blanket term for kids on the
disorder.
Spectrum.
Disorder. I think it's really disorder.
Oh, disorder.
But anyway, go ahead. I could be wrong, but
disorder. You're probably right. Anyway, it's all about songs and little kind of vocal
games
that you can do with your child or with the child that you work with, and establishing kind of a social routine where you are constantly working towards engaging the child first, just maybe by eye contact or a gesture, or even she even talks, as does Dr. Greenspan, about even the avoidance is the response. You know, so anyway, and how to build on that. And her position is, if you can't engage a child in a giggle time, giggle game for at least 10 minutes, don't expect a whole lot of communication from that child. And I don't know about the 10-minute thing, but you and I both know that one of our primary emphasis is, from the beginning, you've got to have that social connection. That child has to want to play with you and want to play with your toys. And she gives some real practical things that she has, again, she's a preschool teacher, but just has has worked with some special needs populations and has established these routines. And they're great, you know, cute and fun, and I've used some of them. I always say, I need to get better. I need to put those in my repertoire better than I have, but it's a great
book. We talked about that today, how we are going to get together and really kind of work through some of these little routines, because we have a lot of the same ones, and especially with little clients that we both share, and this would be a recommendation for other therapists. You know, if you're on teams with the same set of professionals all the time, you really all need to figure out what works with a particular kid, and we've talked about this before too. If I know there's another therapist on a team that I'm serving on and they're getting more than me from a kid, boy, I am on the phone talking to them about, what'd you do? How'd you do that? Why, how did you get that connection? How, I saw in your note, or mom told me that he does this with you. Tell me. And then I try to duplicate that exactly. And that's a conversation that you and I have all the time about kids that we share. We say, oh, wait a minute, back up, tell me how to do it. Tell me exactly what you did.
Then what do you do? Yeah, and it's only part of it is the competitive spirit, and a lot of it really is, you know, you can't get 10 words if I only get 3. No, but a lot of it is, we know that if we go in there using the same script, if you will, and by that I mean routine or song or approach or toy or whatever it is, that got the kid the time before, we're going to start out just a little bit ahead, and that's
right.
Going to help us get to the end result faster, and so it works so much better if everybody kind of does benefit from the other people's experiences and successes, because then you're not starting from ground zero. And parents should feel that way, and all the therapists should feel that way.
Right.
And sometimes that's the case, and sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not. But the thing with giggle time, the thing that I really like about this book, too, is it teaches you how to look for a response that's not necessarily a word.
Right.
You know, and I love what you said. Sometimes it's even a lack of response that you can think, oh, wait a minute, that's not a lack. That's a response. Him turning away from me, that's a response. And so it teaches you how to look for that and how to build on that. And, again, it's something that you might have to read and think, oh, that's so hard. But you start to implement it, and then it's the kind of book that I go back to over and over and over when I want to remind myself about.
And she goes through and talks about a lot of actual kids that, you know, she starts out describing them from when she first met them, and then what she worked on and how they came along over time, and just, you know, very user-friendly and lots of good ideas, practical
it's
things
great
to do with your child, yeah.
Okay, the next thing that I want to talk about is also kind of a Greenspan from his body of work, and it's called the Affect-Based Language Curriculum, the ABLC. It's by Greenspan and Lewis, a name that neither one of us will have trouble pronouncing, Diane Lewis, and she's a speech-language pathologist. And I think, and again, this is my unofficial opinion, but I think that floor time, when it originally came out, was pretty abstract and pretty hard for some people to really learn how to implement, and you and I, gosh, talk about that all the time, or how people kind of incorrectly implement it and think that it doesn't mean that you don't ever have a plan or ever have anything kind of structured to introduce a child to. I think a speech pathologist, you know, and how we practice and, you know, kind of go in with, you know, this is our overall goal today. This is kind of a dream program for those speech pathologists who kind of need something between floor time and something that, an approach that might be so highly structured. But again, I like this book a lot. It's the Affect-Based Language Curriculum. Lewis, I want to say Dr. Lewis, but it's not. I think she's just like me, just a regular therapist with her master's degree. Ms. Lewis also has some training courses too, and Dr. Greenspan as well, that they can really teach how to do floor time, and that would be more for professionals. I think there's some video series too that you can do with a DVD series that you can get to learn how to do floor time.
Yeah, because she kind of puts it to, okay, how do you take floor time and use that in speech therapy? What does that mean if you're a floor time kind of speech therapist? Because sometimes we do have therapists who think they're doing floor time and they do lots of imitating the child or following the child, and at the end of the session, there's not a whole lot that can be pinpointed as far as what did the child do, what, you know.
Or that the child even responded.
Yeah.
You know, that there was even a real response. If you have a professional who's doing nothing but following your kid around and imitating them without any inkling of awareness from your kid, that is not going to be enough to kind of draw him out. And so I love your term when you talk about floor time, is that the main part of that is that you have to be playfully obstructive. You know, you have to learn how to get them to let you in their game, even if they're mad about it, about you wanting to play with them or interfere in their little routine. That's still better than ignoring them and not attending at all. So it is a great guide, the Affect-Based Language Curriculum, for taking language milestones and blending it with the six big developmental milestones from Dr. Greenspan and talking about how all this looks. And it gives you, for all we speechy people, lots of checklists and tools to use like that. Okay, one more book that I want to talk about is called It Takes Two to Talk. And it's also a Hanen program. And again, if I'm mispronouncing that name, I'm so sorry. But it's a shorter book than More Than Words. I think it's a newer book than that. But again, it's a great, easy read for parents and for professionals. So that's another one, too. Did you have any other resources, Kate, that you wanted to specifically mention? Because we're nearly out of time.
No, other than the ones that Carrie talked about for sensory stuff, but we won't rehash those. But if you're wondering what those are, go back to that sensory show and listen. She went through some biggies on sensory stuff. But as far as communication and autism or kids on the spectrum, I'd say those are the first ones I like best, that I've used the most, that we've just mentioned.
Me too. And professionals should always kind of have a list in the back of their mind for what they can encourage parents to read. I just took over, you know, I've built my career on being the replacement speech language pathologist, and I just took over a little girl who was previously in the program and not making very much progress. And that's one of the red flags that the mom said, that she knew the therapist wasn't going to work out, because she said to her, what books should I read? Is there anything I can watch? Are there websites that I can see? And the speech pathologist said, I'll get back to you on that. Like, and she told
her
that.
Did she give her yours?
No, she did not. But
sorry.
She told her, she said for 2 or 3 weeks in a row, she asked her, and this person could not come up with one thing for her to read.
Couldn't give her anything. Oh.
Nothing.
Usually if I have a good book, I'll loan them out to parents. But yeah,
me too.
That's kind of a red flag right there.
That is a red flag that you have a dud. I'm being pretty irreverent tonight. You can tell it's Thursday and I'm tired, sort of. But that, again, those are our very favorite resources that we recommend to parents. And if you're a professional listening to this and don't have your own little reading list that you recommend, either mentally or one that you've taken the time to type up, you know, that would be something I would get on today. You know, that's something you need to do. Okay, we've only got about a minute left, and I really did want to talk about this whole to diagnose or not to diagnose piece, and I think the only thing I really want to say about that is parents sometimes really belabor that point, and, you know, after we've established a relationship and after we've talked about it and talked about it, I usually always do end up at some point saying, you know, everybody already knows. They kind of know there's a problem. They may not know what to call it, but the preschool teacher knows he's different from other kids. The grandparents know. You know, they may not have a word for it, but I think that scares parents so much is that they somehow think, if I don't get a formal diagnosis for it, I'm not going to be embarrassed about it, and nobody's going to say anything, and nobody's going to notice. And, you know, as you always say, Kate, the truth is they know anyway. And so I just would encourage parents in the kindest, most loving way that I can say this, that's really about you and you not wanting to have that happen to you as a parent. But the thing that you need to do for your child is go ahead and follow through with intervention. And parents who really can't stand that, I tell them, well, I don't care what we call this. I don't care what you want to say. We're going to focus on what we know works to make these skills that he or she haven't mastered better. We're going to work hard on this, on communication or on understanding language or on talking. And it doesn't matter what we call it right now, but at some point in the future, you know, you're going to want to revisit this, and you are going to probably want to call this something because, again, I think that's always about the parents. I don't know if you have anything you want to finish up and say about that.
Well, and Lisa may speak, Dr. Powell may speak about this next week, but there are some practical reasons as far as getting more services for your child.
Right.
If they are diagnosed, there are programs that have dollars available for additional therapies. There are standalone programs within the school who may better meet the needs of your child. I mean, there are reasons to have that diagnosis. And I think it kind of helps parents have some more insight into, although, you know, every child is different, whether they're on the spectrum or not, but it does kind of answer some big general questions about why does this happen? Why is this an issue? And gives a lot of good direction about where the primary focus of your efforts should be as far as helping your child to develop and, you know, make progress. And so there are really practical reasons. And I do, just as you do, Laura, understand how hard that must be. But in the end, like you said, really people who deal with your child, whether they label it or know that it even has a label, they know something is different. So it doesn't really change that. But, you know, anyway, that's all.
That's all on that. We just wanted to be sure to say that because that's something that I hear all the time. And that's a hard conversation that I have with parents. And sometimes it's one conversation. Sometimes it's every darn week that I see that kid between the time that I get them and the time they turn three that we talk about that. And so we all just have to work through those things at our own pace. But I did want to talk about it and say, you know, sometimes that really isn't more about your issues and your things that you have to come to grips with as a mom or parenting a child who may need special help for a long time. So there's that.
Or a dad. Actually, I think I have more dads too who have trouble accepting that maybe there is a name for this or maybe there is a diagnosis.
Right.
Yeah. But, yeah.
And that's a whole other show.
Yeah.
Talking about dads. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole other one. But, yeah, it's a hard one and, you know, normally parents do come along eventually, some faster than others, but it's an issue. So.
It is. Okay, well, we're at the end of our hour, and I think we almost talked about everything that I wanted to talk to you about tonight, so that's a new record. Next week, we're so excited to have Dr. Powell on, Lisa Powell, our colleague and friend, who is a pediatric psychologist, and she routinely diagnoses children with autism, and she works in our system, and not only is she a great diagnostician, she's a great, I was going to say therapist, but she probably wouldn't like that term.
Clinician? Would that be appropriate?
Clinician, there we go. She's a great clinician, so she not only knows how to diagnose it, she also knows how to treat it, and again, I've already talked about how important that is to me as a working, practicing clinician. that someone actually be able to tell you not only what's wrong, but what we need to do about it and how we can make it better. So that's going to be next week.
I think she has four kids, so if,
yeah,
if all that else
mom.
Fails, she's a mother of four. So,
yeah,
yeah, she's great, and she'll be great to have on to be able to ask them. And if you're having specific questions regarding autism or the diagnosis of autism, call in next week if you didn't make it this week.
Yeah, next week, next Thursday night at 6 o'clock. All right, I think that'll do it for tonight. Thanks, Kay.
Okay. Thanks, Laura.
Bye.
Bye.